My name's John Hillary. I'm the Executive Director of War on Want, and I'm joined here to discuss finance, corporate accountability, social responsibility with Damon Gibbons, who is the Chief Executive of the Centre for Responsible Credit, and Nick Dearden, who is the Director of the Jubilee Debt Campaign. And we're going to start by discussing where we feel the financial crisis came from. And to start from just putting forward a bit of War on Want's perspective on that, we see the causes of the financial and the economic crisis being 30 years of runaway liberalisation and deregulation promoted by obviously the richest countries in the world and the financial corporations within them, but also through institutions such as the IMF and the World Trade Organization, which we'll be discussing in a moment. And I think from what we've agreed, we're going to talk about the causes of the financial crisis, then the role of those institutions within them, and then hopefully some good positive suggestions for alternatives and positive solutions out of the crisis. So, Damon, should we start off with you for a sort of a broad overview?
Fine. I mean, I certainly wouldn't disagree with the broad sweep of starting 30 years ago and looking at financial liberalisation and so forth. But I think where we come from is probably looking a little bit more in detail at the role of credit in society and how fundamentally we perhaps mistook the growth of credit as a good thing of its own volition without looking particularly at how credit was being used and therefore the different purposes to which credit is put. And in the case of the crisis, clearly lots of credit advanced either for speculative purposes effectively on the housing markets or for consumption purposes, which has got huge consequences, not only for the sustainability of household budgets, which ultimately collapse, but also for the sustainability of the use of the Earth's resources in terms of bringing forward all of that consumption. So I think the use of credit to us becomes much more important and therefore something which we want to focus on moving forwards, not to turn our back necessarily on credit altogether, because we still think that does have a role to play in supporting sustainable growth moving forward, but to make sure that is sustainable by actually looking at how we can best use it.
Mm. I mean, Nick, obviously one man's credit is another man's debt.
Exactly.
And that brings you in beautifully in the other side.
It fits in very nicely, and I think, I mean, I agree that at the very centre of this there is a problem about credit, and essentially that's who controls credit and to what uses it's put and how responsibly it's used. And we campaign on the third world debt crisis, so this was a crisis that emerged in the late 1970s, early 1980s, after third world countries, scores of third world countries, had been lent enormous sums of money by the banks because it was seen that they were a good way of making profit. It was lent, for the most part, completely irresponsibly. It was used to prop up all manner of unsavoury regimes for useless projects that never benefited the country in question and so on. And then when those same banks turned around and put up interest rates, the debt crisis was sprung. And those countries have been living in the stranglehold of debt for the past 30 years, even with some small amounts of debt cancellation, which have been very welcome and have been given. Nonetheless, that debt has not only been used to drain those economies of resources and wealth and to ensure the net flow of capital flows from the south to the northern hemisphere, the northern world, but also to exert a political control on those countries, which has been used to implement exactly the kind of policies that you were talking about, the trade liberalisation, the financial liberalisation, the increasing way that governments in the developing world, and you can argue governments in the developed world, are unable to control their own economies in the interests and for the needs of their own people and are completely at the whim of the financial markets and those who control credit. Mm.
But, I mean, in a way, that you've mentioned the political aspect, and obviously for War on Want, the whole of this is political, and it's a political agenda. And maybe can I throw that back to you, Damon? Because you were saying that you feel that we felt that credit was a good thing, and that sounds to me a bit of a sort of apolitical argument. From our side, it's much more that there was a very distinct political agenda here to be able to keep corporate profits high, even while wages were declining as a share of national income, and that credit was specifically designed in order to keep the system going when actually it had no foundations on which to keep going. So it wasn't so much as a mistake, and that people hadn't quite noticed what had happened in the 30s, but it was actually a deliberate plot, and on the back of which was the whole thing about the sale of council housing and all of the construction of the wherewithal on which people could borrow these ridiculous sums.
No, I don't dispute that. I think that there was a definite deliberate political and economic ideology which drove this, and that therefore expresses itself in a number of ways. I mean, I talk about it as a mistake, not in an accidental way, but a mistake which has had huge consequences, a deliberate policy error taken for political reasons, which has had huge consequences for us all now. And I think Nick's point is well made, which is that effectively international finance saw countries, some countries, as subprime countries and lent to them at rates which they could never really afford to repay. And in fact, their desire and need for credit came because of the simple fact that they couldn't manage their own needs within the budgets and resources that they've got. So they were exploited deliberately on disadvantaged terms because of that need to take out credit to shore up effectively holes in their national balance sheets. The same is true for low-income households in the developed world, where actually we've seen this growth of subprime markets cast out from mainstream banking, having to rely on extremely high cost credit and using that credit just to shore up inadequate incomes that people are living on. And so what's happened to countries in Nick's campaign is also happening to communities within the UK and within Europe, which is largely my campaigning area. But the actual causes of that are exactly the same, as you point out, that it is a deliberate ideology, and the consequences for wealth inequality are absolutely huge and catastrophic.
Mm. I mean, I think that brings us on again to this issue around who's driving it, and then maybe we should touch on the institutions which are behind this, because clearly this idea of whether or not the international debt crisis was led by a desire for credit or a desire actually to offload the billions in petrodollars that people had sloshing around in the system from the 70s onwards, we would certainly see that the political agenda being exactly, as you pointed out, Nick, that basically the IMF and the World Bank were given power over countries throughout the world, and the IMF's role in particular was capital account liberalization. So removing the capital controls which many developing countries had had on their systems to be able to protect themselves precisely from the type of hot money speculation which then poured in and poured out. And what's astonishing, if you look at the sort of figures in terms of the rise in financial services activities from 1990 till today, 20 years later, I think I'm right in saying that in 1990, financial services transactions amounted to 15 times world GDP, and now they're 75 times world GDP. And that growth of 500% is made up almost exclusively of derivatives trade, almost all of which is speculative. So we've had 20 years of extraordinary increased activity in the financial services market to no socially useful purpose whatsoever, and just a massive bonanza for those who are trading off the back of it. Mm. Is that square with?
Well, it does, and part and parcel of that is the increasing disparity in wealth across the world between North and South, but also between different classes of people on an international scale. And that comes back exactly to your point about why this was lent in the first place. I mean, I've been talking to people recently, and there's a really, there's an almost prejudice, I suppose, in our society now that if you take out a mortgage or if you take out debt, it's your fault and you are personally responsible for paying that back. And there's a real, and again, I think it's been manufactured, a real inability to see the structural causes behind all of this. And if you actually look at declining real incomes of people right across the world, but in the West as well, those same poor households who have been extended credit in order just to live, to have a basic standard of living, to have somewhere to live that's safe and comfortable and so on. That's been done in order to make up for the fact that the economic system we're talking about has created these disparities in the first place.
That's absolutely true. And I think that the issue here is, you know, why did this happen 30 years ago? Well, when the welfare state was in crisis and when Keynesianism wasn't, you know, facing particular problems dealing with the economic difficulties at that time. And the attempt to actually say, I think, by neoliberals, that the welfare state can no longer be afforded. and therefore the responsibility for welfare has to come down from the state and rest with the individual. And so actually what we've seen therefore is lots of things that the state used to provide now effectively being financed or at least managed through the use of financial services on an individual household level. And so people are responsible for their own housing, they need a mortgage for this. If you want to go to university, you have to get a loan for this. You know, numerous examples of investment in skills and other areas. But also at the same time, then a relaxation, as I came back to my initial point, about saying, well, credit can be used for those productive sorts of investments, but it can also be used to just give people the opportunity to spend money. And individually, we're actually not very good at deciding how much credit we ought to take on, given our future life trajectories, if you like, and how much we can afford to pay back. And so that led to a huge desire for more credit than could actually be sustainably financed.
But again, I mean, I think I see this financialization of the economy again as being also very much supply-led, because there was obviously such huge profits in it from the point of view of the financial services industry. And certainly from my own background at War on Want, working on issues of international trade and financial services trade in particular, that's when we saw that the IMF had almost created the playing field by getting rid of all the capital account controls. And then the World Trade Organization then led to this enormous explosion of these new trading instruments.
But slightly more than that. I mean, I think undoubtedly on the very macro level that's true. But, you know, beneath that, the IMF was very keen on the originate-to-distribute model in terms of credit markets that it was liberalizing. So it was allowing banks and lenders to effectively make loans, securitize them all, distribute it out, raise more money off the investment markets to put out on loan again quicker. And that's actually a very rapid model for unsustainable but rapid growth in terms of consumption, which happened through that mechanism.
Can I just add one more thing there, which for me has always been critical, that obviously we talk about the IMF and the WTO, but actually behind them, the driving forces are firstly the countries which are their members, but most importantly the lobby groups and the financial services industry themselves, which I know certainly in the WTO context has been absolutely critical, and the UK has played a role greater than any other country in promoting that drive towards financial services liberalisation. And I mean, is that something that you've found in respect of the debt agenda as well, that the UK has got a particular problem in that respect?
Well, it has. I mean, it's funny because the UK obviously prides itself on being the country, especially under the Labour government, which took a real interest and concern for the amount of debt that was building up in developing countries and how it was preventing them from social development, from spending on education and health and so on. But at the same time, it was the same government that was, even through what it was doing in the world of trade, but even through its aid provision and so on, had exactly the same response to the welfare state as the neoliberals that you were talking about at the beginning of the system. And so right across Africa, Asia and Latin America, there was a real push for the private sector knows everything, and if you just get the investment into those countries, the private sector will provide health and education and other things, and it clearly didn't happen. But the interesting thing I find is the contradiction between that and the role that the IMF's played, actually, because the IMF, far from following its supposed free market model, has actually been the institution that bailed out all of the banks when they first gave the debt, the loans in the first place, that created third world debt. I mean, the IMF is responsible for turning what in many countries was a crisis of the private sector into a crisis of the public sector.
Yes.
And we've seen it play exactly the same role, of course, with regards to the new financial crisis now.
Absolutely.
And what's being really played out at the moment is that households and individuals are not going to be allowed to escape the repayment of the credit debts that they effectively gathered over that period, but also they are going to have to pay through increased taxation or through spending cuts for the bailouts of banks. So we've effectively restored the financial services balance sheets at the expense of households. A really good example of that is what's happening in Greece at the moment, where there's been a draft insolvency law on the table for 9 months, and it has been held up, and this would allow people as drafted, I believe, to allow people to escape their debts much more easily than was in the past. But because of the recent developments in Greece, that is now being put on ice, and effectively people are going to be held to full repayment of their debts.
I mean, that maybe brings us on to this next point about whether or not there's been any attempt to challenge the structural problems beneath which caused the financial crisis, and in fact underlie the whole of the capitalist model itself. Because certainly, again, in that international context, we've seen the British government push very, very hard for the conclusion of the Doha round of trade organization, World Trade Organization talks, which includes a substantial portion about further deregulation and further liberalization of financial services markets, which you'd have to have been asleep for the last 4 or 5 years not to recognize has been the absolutely fundamental cause of the problem. So once again, we seem to have these completely crossed wires in terms of getting us into a situation where we're not just going to be replicating crisis after crisis.
And at an international level, it's exactly the same institutions that have been re-empowered who failed to see the crisis coming in the first place, who caused the crisis in many ways by their agenda of financial liberalisation, who've now been put in charge through enormous new capital of the International Monetary Fund, through the re-empowerment of export credit agencies. Those very same institutions are now supposed to be in charge of getting us out of this.
Which I suppose is a question now, which we should put. I mean, do we feel that these institutions should have any role to play?
Well, no. I mean, I think certainly there is this huge problem of all public policy responses at the minute are subject to market approval. Yeah. And so, you know, the shift that has taken place just over the last 12 months between sort of, well, you know, we're going to grow our way out of this economy, there will have to be, you know, more emphasis on investment and growth and getting the economies back on track, not about deficit reduction because of the risks that poses to households and to businesses, completely reversed because of market disapproval.
And the whole idea of this restoring confidence, you think, whose confidence? Ah, the credit rating agency's confidence, thanks for telling us.
But it's been shown again and again and again that traditional standard response which emanates from the International Monetary Fund and the markets is wrong, actually. It's wrong in terms of getting economies back on their feet again. I mean, even just in terms of a rational economic system, it just isn't right. And it's interesting that the medicine the IMF is now pushing on Eastern European states particularly is exactly the same medicine they pushed in the 1980s and 90s on African and South American states. And it proved to be utterly, utterly unsuccessful in achieving growth.
And already in countries like Latvia, we're seeing absolutely disastrous of spiralling into long-term recession, which I think for me, and certainly for Warren Wont's position, really underlines the fact that these are not reformable institutions. I mean, we've been through 30 years, 40 years of saying, let's reform the IMF, let's reform the World Bank, try and reform the WCO ever since it came into being in 95. But fundamentally, they're set up, these institutions, with one particular liberalisation dogma underpinning them. And there is no reforming them. And I think that's why we need to be searching now for solutions and alternatives which go in a very different way, both in institutions and in terms of perhaps the policy choices on the
way. I completely agree with that prognosis. I mean, I think the difficulty is that no matter how internationalised policymakers want to be and take the broad overview of what's happening at the moment, what we have are a number of very powerful market actors who respond individually in giving their approval or not for their immediate interests. And so clearly we can see that it's a collective madness that's resulting, but actually, you know, if you're an individual finance agency responsible for bond investments and so forth, you just see immediately what is happening and whether or not there is a risk of default, and you put up your rates accordingly for sovereign debt. And that, therefore, is the market disapproval immediately, which means that policymakers just can't confront.
But then surely the question is, why are we in hock to these credit rating agencies?
Yes,
you know, why are we as nation states in some way subordinated to the whims of the market?
Absolutely. And I mean, well, again, that was part of the political project, wasn't it? But there are structural solutions to that, you know, people have been talking about for the last 30, 40, even 50 years in the case of some of the things that Keynes was talking about at the end of the Second World War. So, I mean, we campaign and have campaigned for a long time on a form of debt court, a form of insolvency procedure for countries like Greece, which would mean that they couldn't simply be held to ransom by the markets and squeezed dry. And there would be an orderly workout process which would recognise that states have duties not simply to repay debts to financial markets, but to their own citizens, and to realise their human rights. And that goes for other elements of the economy too. So the fact that the dollar is the reserve currency of the international markets essentially means developing world countries are subsidizing overconsumption in the United States because it's a form of cheap lending mm-hmm. to the United States. So there's been talk for, as I say, I mean, since the Second World War about the possibility of creating an international clearing union, which would change that and would make it just as difficult for states to have big surpluses as big deficits and so on. There's capital controls mm-hmm. that you've talked about already. There's the idea of a Tobin tax, which would slow down the way that speculative capital can play on economies.
While raising lots of nice money for other
But very little of that's on the political future. Agenda.
It is, yes. And in fact, even when some policy ideas which could help. I mean, for example, there was within the IMF the proposal last year that perhaps they should move away from their inflation targets for central banks. Now, this is a very good way of writing debt off for individuals and houses. A dose of inflation means that, you know, the amount of money they owe relative to other things is falling. What was interesting about that play out was that it was proposed. We then had virtually immediately afterwards the situation in Greece and the disasters there, and then there was a big shift away to a firm fix on inflation as a central bank mission again, you know, to control that. So I think that certainly something does need to be done. I think one of the things that needs to be done, certainly in terms of the bond markets, is that we shouldn't allow them to pick off one country at a time. I mean, in fact, you know, if we just downgraded everybody's sovereign debt ratings at the same time, we wouldn't have necessarily the problems which we're facing at the moment. It's the threat of, you know, going through Greece and then into Spain and Portugal, and then in the UK policymakers saying, oh, you know, this could be bad news for us. But actually, if we just accepted that all of this has to be downgraded and therefore an element of it written off, and the banks and those financial institutions take that hit, then actually that's probably a better way.
I think for me, ultimately, there has to be a more thoroughgoing and radical approach which actually begins to question the role of the market in society as a whole, and certainly to subordinate the financial services industries so that they have some socially useful purpose again. And that idea of bringing the requirements of the rest of society in and maybe shrinking a great deal. I mean, certainly banning naked credit default swaps is something which the Germans have already said they want to do. Getting rid of speculation and hedge funds, derivatives trade, whether it be in commodities or oil or currencies, it just seems a no-brainer. I mean, why on earth are we not just saying that straight away? But then there's a much greater sense of trying to bring banks back into society so that actually instead of having this superstructure of completely mad speculation, they go back to doing what banks are meant to do as public utilities, which is taking in the surplus for those who've got surplus at any one particular time and lending it out to others who need to borrow on it.
For productive purposes.
This is one way of dealing with it, is effectively to wrap the current debt problem that we've got, reschedule it and reinvest it in productive uses, you know, which actually could be a means around this. You are at least offering those financial services that play ball, those banks and lenders that play ball with that idea, some way of still making a return in the long run on the money that we're talking about, as opposed to just simply taking a hit on it and losing it altogether.
I mean, internationally, we've seen already some countries doing some of these things, haven't we?
Well, I think it is happening in some countries at a national level, but we've all said that the problems we're talking about are political in their nature, and so I think it's not enough, I suppose, for us to dream up solutions that would rationally work in an economic setting. It's a political project that we have to engage in as well. And I think you're seeing it very much in some South American countries who are taking a radically different economic direction to countries of the developed world, and are setting up alternative development banks, are setting up alternative trading structures, which instead of being based on competition and the idea of sweatshop labour and so on, are based on redistribution, solidarity and complementarity. Radical ideas in the world of economics, actually. Alternative funds, mm-hmm. Monetary funds, alternative currency units, mm-hmm. And there are some of them getting together and actually saying, well, simply why are we paying this debt if we believe it's unjust? And that's very interesting, because it shows that at the end of the day, it isn't necessarily the rationally thought out plans that mean things change. It is simply a group of social movements, of campaigning organisations, of country leaderships getting together and saying,
it's a very good point. I mean, countries have defaulted on their debt, you know, throughout history, and you know, have yet come back again, you know, in terms
of Argentina.
Argentina's a classic example.
But there's a question here. I mean, certainly things like the Banco del Sur and the Chiang Mai initiative in East Asia, where again it's about trying to take over your own control of credit and to be able to share that out amongst you. I mean, I suppose one could say in the British context, credit, or national context everywhere, credit unions fulfill exactly that type of purpose. But my problem, I suppose, is that while that works if you happen to be ASEAN and China or Brazil, Bolivia and all of the others, it doesn't work so well on a huge level for credit unions. How can we then take control in terms of this political project of the state's distribution of finance and the state's reappropriation of the democratic space to be able to put banks back in their place?
Well, I think there are moves clearly around disclosure of where banks are lending, how they're lending and so forth, which are really important. You've got things like the Community Reinvestment Act within the US, which made a huge bonus in terms of the amount of capital investment in poorer areas. It was blamed initially within the crisis for allowing mortgage loans to people on low incomes, but actually all the research seems to indicate that those CRA-originated loans had much lower default rates than loans which were made by lenders that were outside the CRA regime. So actually I think that level of community accountability for what capital is doing, who's getting it, what it's being used for.
But not community control? I mean, surely nationalisation, given that we bought the banks, we seem to have given them back. Exactly.
I mean, if we wanted to, and if what we're talking about is social control, is finance working for the people, by the people, then this is the time to do it.
Well, I think control is a word which, you know, there's a spectrum of how much you control something and what the levers are that you pull to achieve that. And control ownership are not necessarily the same thing.
Absolutely, we seem to own it, but not control it at the moment. We've got it exactly the wrong way around.
That's a very good point.
But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there are things that, and in fact many of the more enlightened within the financial services industry themselves would actually say, you know, yes, we are prepared to open up more about what we do here, to be held to account by it, and to invite communities in with regards to some of that. So I think that that's worth building on. It would be a mistake to think that everybody within the financial services industry fails to recognise the problems that they've been caused, the responsibility that they share for it, or indeed to think that they disapprove of any changes.
Well, we've heard radical stuff from, you know, surprising people like Adair Turner, for example, haven't we? Who said, you know, we need to be really careful about this idea that's almost become an ideology that everything the financial sector does is necessarily good and for the good. And
but the problem is, I suppose, I mean, while one or two people have said that the emperor has no clothes, the massive power of the banking industry and the financial services lobby has come around to say, yes, he is in fact wearing excellent clothes and we support it for the future without much change.
Yeah, I mean, I think we must also say that on some occasions they have just failed themselves to recognise what was fairly obvious. And the housing market, which Adair Turner refers to recently in terms of the work of the FSA, the classic point in case, the more money you put out for mortgage loans, the more demand you create in terms of house prices, because you cannot expand the supply of houses as quickly as you can pump credit out there for people to buy them. And so that then looks to banks and lenders that actually they should lend more because it's safer to lend more because values are rising. And so it's not surprising we end up with bubbles in the housing market as a result of that. Now, lenders themselves just look at the numbers on that and say, well, it's just still safe for us to lend. It's still safe for us to pump more money out. They're not that clever.
So are we optimistic about the future or are we pessimistic about the future?
Well, it depends what day you ask me the question on, probably. You can see absolutely amazing examples across the world of people really saying we've had enough of this system, the way this works, and trying to take control and doing that through, you know, campaigning, the sort of stuff that we all do, and actually working and achieving something. At the same time, there's no question we have a financial crisis, the worst in 70 years, that's been going on now for 2 years, and we see very little sign of real change, of really dealing with the structural problems in the system. So you know, as always, I think it's probably up to us as people in our societies, as campaign groups and whatever, to decide how this...
Yes, I mean, I'm very pessimistic about the immediate, I mean, sort of next 5 years or so, in terms of what that means for people. I'm extremely pessimistic about the human consequences of the crisis. I think that we will have low growth. I think that we will see high levels of unemployment and that that will drag on for quite some time. I think as that does happen and more people do go to the wall, the voices for change will become louder. And I'm optimistic that in the end, you know, there will be some fundamental rethink of how credit operates in society and how financial services.
Well, that's good, because I think that means we are united in a final analysis that, according to Romain Rolland, in the statement which was Antonio Gramsci's favourite statement, apparently, we are pessimists of the intellect but optimists of the will.